Chapter 25. Aubrey. Once I'm through the gate, I park my bike behind a thick tangle of honeysuckle shrubs and approach the driveway leading to Catmint House, considering my next steps. I can't exactly waltz up to the front door all, "Hey, hi, could you spit into a cup for me? Just need a little DNA and I'll be on my way." Even thinking the words makes me feel like I'm losing my mind. Sane people don't break into mansions looking for evidence that their grandmother is an imposter. I kept asking myself as I pedaled here if there might be an explanation for the lack of a birthmark on my grandmother's hand. Maybe she had it lasered off? I'd asked about laser removal when I got teased mercilessly as a preteen. "You should be proud," my father said. "Your grandmother was. She wouldn't remove part of herself to please other people." Which was actually good advice for once, but my mother agreed to let me consult with a few plastic surgeons. They all said the same thing. The color was too dense and too deep. It might fade a little, but it would never go away completely. Maybe she was wearing makeup? But then why the gloves? Why the gloves always, even on a hot summer day? Maybe you just missed it. I hadn't, though. I know that birthmark like the back of my hand, and that's exactly where it should have been on her. It's the only characteristic my grandmother and I share, and it wasn't there. I'm sure of that. The lush landscaping of the grounds lets me skirt behind bushes all the way up the driveway and then around to the back of the house. Then I pause, looking at the sun-drenched yard. It's surprisingly big, given how close to the cliff Catmint House looks from a distance, and not as well maintained as the front. The grass is too long, the bushes too wild, and the flowers are unkempt and overgrown. I can hear the roar of the sea crashing against the rocks behind the house, and the faint cries of seagulls circling above. What am I doing? I start to back up, suddenly horrified with myself. I'm trespassing, is what I'm doing, with the intent to break into a house whose owner explicitly told me to stay away. I could get arrested for this. And for what? I should just tell somebody my suspicions and leave it to the police, or whoever, to sort everything out. And then I see it. A first-floor window, barely 5 feet off the ground, half open. It almost looks like an invitation. I creep forward until I'm beneath the sill, then raise myself on tiptoes to peer inside. It's a beautiful room, with crown molding and an elaborate chandelier, but it looks as though it's being used for storage space. It's empty except for piles of boxes, rolled-up rugs, and chairs stacked neatly one on top of the other. The hallway behind the open inner door is silent and dim. Am I really going to do this? Can I do this? I curl my palms around the sill, debating. I haven't worked out here like I did while I was swimming competitively, and it doesn't take long to lose muscle strength. But I've always been good at pull-ups. I take a deep breath and hoist myself up, surprised at how easily I rise. My feet scramble for purchase on the side of the house, and I almost lose my grip, but I manage to get one arm up and over the windowsill, which gives me enough leverage to pull myself halfway through. I stay there for a few seconds, panting, then crawl the rest of the way inside. I land in a crouch, flexing my sore palms. "Take that, Dad," I think as I rise. Arm strength comes in handy sometimes. I have no idea what part of the house I'm in. I slip off my sneakers and leave them beside the window, then pad across the hardwood floor until I get to the doorway. I move silently down the hall, pausing after every step, until I come to a staircase. I stand there a long time, straining my ears for any signal that someone's near the top, but there's nothing. I navigate the stairs carefully, stepping lightly until I'm on the upstairs landing. I don't know what part of the house I'm in, but it's so quiet that I become a little bolder and move more quickly. Maybe I got lucky, and nobody's home. I climb a second set of stairs, steeper and narrower, and pause at the door at the top. I place my hand on the knob and turn slowly as far as I can. Then I push. It swings open with only the tiniest creaking noise, and I peer into a wide hallway. There are doors on either side, and my heart starts pounding when I realize that I might have found a back stairway to the bedroom area, which is where I need to be, because the only way I can be sure that I'm grabbing something of Gran's is to take it from her room. I approach the first door noiselessly and open it quickly, stepping inside. Right away, I know this isn't anyone's current bedroom. It has a deserted, musty feeling to it. Not to mention outdated curtains and bed linens that look like they haven't been changed in years. There's a red blanket at the foot of the bed that reads Martindale Prep in bold white letters, and two lacrosse sticks propped in one corner. Wait, could this be my dad's old room? I creep in a little farther and spy a framed photo on the wall beside the window. It's the same picture of my father and Gran that I saw in Sweet Fern, the two of them holding that ugly painting and beaming for the camera. I zero in on my grandmother's hand, dominated by that prominent birthmark. Lovely picture, isn't it? I spin to see Gran, or whoever she is, standing in the doorway. At first, all I take in is that for once she's not dressed to the nines or wearing gloves. Then I notice the small pearl-handled pistol in one of her hands. It's so pretty, it almost doesn't look... Oh, it's real. And it's loaded, she says, stepping into the room. Two elderly women living alone can't be too careful. The look she gives me is almost sympathetic. Did you honestly think we're not alerted when the gate opens? I lick my lips, which have gone suddenly dry. So, what? You let me come in? I opened the window for you. Stupid, 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 I berate myself. Well, you caught me, I say, affecting a guilty laugh. It comes out like more of a wheeze. I wanted to see this place one more time, try to find my father's room, and I did, so I'll just leave now. No, you won't. My heart sinks as she takes another step forward. I wondered yesterday if you got a good look at my hand. I take it you did? I'm too frozen to even nod. And now here you are, Adam's daughter. It would be quite a poetic tragedy if I mistook you for a burglar and shot you in his old room, wouldn't it? I told people. I blurt out the lie as convincingly as I can. I told everyone what I saw. Uncle Archer and Millie and Jonah and everyone. Gran, or Mildred, or I don't even know what to call her anymore, tilts her head to one side. And yet, you're here all alone. My blood runs cold. I got one text off to Uncle Archer, and there's not much chance that he'll know what I meant. What did you do to my grandmother? I ask, my voice trembling. Nothing, she says, with such quick certainty that I actually believe her. Your grandmother died of natural causes 24 years ago. I found her here. She liked to spend time in Adam's room while he was gone. Her eyes flash. He was always her favorite, even though he was the least attentive child. You're Teresa, I say. She doesn't deny it. And the other Teresa? I have no idea how to finish that sentence. She doesn't satisfy my curiosity. It's odd, she says musingly. I took everything I could from Adam, and for all these years, it's never felt like enough. Maybe taking his only child would be. My heart drops into my feet, and I almost blurt, I'm not his only child, before she adds, after all, he took mine. The world tilts on its axis. My father killed your son? In a manner of speaking. A loud, crashing noise startles us both. I move instinctively toward the window, reaching its edge before Teresa's commanding, stop, makes me pause. But I can see enough to make out a large black SUV barreling across the lawn. It's such a bizarre, out-of-context, yet blessedly welcome sight that I almost laugh out loud. Tess, a woman's voice, loud and agitated, calls from downstairs. Tess, someone is driving up to the house. Tess! I see, Teresa calls back. She looks remarkably calm for someone whose house might be plowed into any second. But the car stops a few feet from the front door, and, with a mix of relief and apprehension, I watch Uncle Archer get out of the driver's seat. So you weren't lying, Teresa says. Well, we had a good run, I suppose. The hand holding the gun drops slightly, and I feel a surge of hope until her face hardens. May as well see things to their inevitable conclusion. Come along. She steps into the hallway, gesturing for me to follow, and crosses to the balcony staircase overlooking the second floor of the house. Show our guest into the sunroom, she calls downstairs. Tell him Aubrey will be right there. What are you going to do? I ask anxiously. Please don't hurt him. The thought of anything happening to Uncle Archer because he came after me makes me sick to my stomach. Downstairs, she orders. The look in her eye is so deadly that I do what she says. She directs me, left at the foot of the stairs, right into the hallway, another right, until I'm in the doorway of a room that's floor-to-ceiling windows on three sides. At its center, Uncle Archer stands beside the woman I thought was Teresa Ryan. Aubrey, he cries. He strides forward, mouth open to say more, until the real Teresa appears beside me, gun in hand. Archer stops short, his eyes boring into hers. Oh my God, he says hoarsely, one hand curling into his chest. It's true. It really is true. I thought there had to be some mistake, but you're not my mother. The muscle in his jaw jumps. If I'd ever gotten within 10 feet of you before now, I would have known in an instant. Possibly not, Teresa says. We see what we expect to see. But you understand now, I suppose, why I had to cut off contact. Her voice doesn't soften exactly, but it's less steely when she adds, even with you, who's relatively innocent in all this. All what? Archer asks. Why would you do this? What did we ever do to you? His gaze flits between Teresa, the gun, and me. Is this about what happened to Kayla? Or to Matt? Paula, Teresa says. I have no idea who she's referring to until the second woman steps forward. There's a chill in the air. Why don't you light a fire in the south parlor and then leave us to talk about? She pauses, eyes glinting. What happened to Matt? Tess, are you sure? The other woman says nervously. Positive, Teresa says. Paula brushes past us into the hallway. Uncle Archer takes a deep breath. Matt drowned, and that's awful, but Matt didn't drown, Teresa says sharply. He was killed. That night at Cuddy Beach, Matt would never have gone into the water on his own. He might have been drinking, but he wasn't a fool. He knew what the undertow could do on a night like that. Your snake of a brother, Anders, told him that Kayla had been swept away by the tide and needed help. Kayla? Uncle Archer looks bewildered. She wasn't even there. Teresa's lip curls. No. And Anders was perfectly aware of that. He lied to get Matt in the water. He knew he'd probably never come out. And Adam. Adam was standing right next to them. And he let Matt go. She's shaking now, her eyes wide and shiny. Adam just let him go. Adam just let him go. The words ring so loud in my ears that I almost miss Uncle Archer's next question. How could you possibly know that? Kayla, Teresa says. Anders got drunk one night and spilled everything to her. I don't think he even remembered doing it. But she told me. Said he'd always been jealous of Matt and resented him even more when Matt got Allison pregnant the summer he died. She laughs bitterly at Uncle Archer's shocked expression. You didn't know? Me either. My grandchild. Imagine that. And your mother's. But Allison miscarried. She did? Uncle Archer asks blankly. Yes. Teresa's mouth presses into a thin line. And she knew what happened to Matt. Anders told her that night. And I'll say this for her. At least she sounded the alarm that he was missing. But then she protected her brothers. She let everyone think it was an accident. Kayla told you all this, Uncle Archer says slowly. And then what? You killed her? drugged her and put her in her car? Teresa startles, and Uncle Archer presses. Fred Baxter gave me the original autopsy report. There was a sedative in her system the night she died. So that's why she asked about Kayla, Teresa says, looking at me. I've become she all of a sudden, a prop in the conversation. You killed an innocent girl, and you have the nerve to play victim? Uncle Archer asks, his voice rising. That wasn't me, Teresa insists. It's just everything happened at once. I found out about Matt. I was devastated and furious. The only thing I wanted in the world was to make your brothers and sister pay somehow. And then your mother died. Her eyes got a faraway look. She and I had been alone in the house. I called Donald Camden because, well, we called Donald for everything back then. He said something about how you children would burn through Abraham and Mildred's fortune in no time flat. And I got an idea. The edges of her mouth curve into a smile, and it's a gruesome sight. It seemed ridiculous at first, but Donald loved it. He'd always wanted to get his hands on your parents' money. We looped in Fred Baxter, who was drowning in debt, and promised to make all that go away if he'd keep acting as my physician. We buried Mildred here, on the grounds of Catmint House, and I brought my sister, Paula, here to take my place. Then Donald wrote to all of you. Teresa's face tightens. But Kayla kept trying to see me. She wanted to know if Mrs. Story had disinherited the children because of what I told her. I talked to her on the phone a few times, trying to placate her, but she just became more agitated. I stopped taking her calls, and she went to Fred Baxter. He urged her not to worry about it, to keep quiet, but then she asked Donald, and Donald, well, he thought it would become a problem if she kept talking. If people knew I had a reason to hate the Story children. So he took matters into his own hands. A defensive note creeps into her voice at Uncle Archer's horrified expression. Fred and I wouldn't have condoned that. But by the time we realized what had happened, it was too late. Well, aren't you and Fred just a pair of ever-loving saints? Uncle Archer says icily. Then he draws in a sharp, shocked breath. Holy shit. Is that what happened to Fred, too? He started talking this summer, trying to piece together a confession in that addled brain of his. So Donald took matters into his own hands? Drowned the man in his own backyard? He takes a step forward, and something cold and hard presses into the side of my neck. I whimper involuntarily, and Uncle Archer freezes. Let's not forget who's in charge here. Teresa says. Uncle Archer raises both hands in a gesture of surrender. I'm not coming any closer, okay? But it's over. You have to know that. You can't put the genie back in the bottle this time. Probably not, Teresa says. But I beg to disagree with you that it's over. Because here's the thing. Her voice turns musing. Adam is the worst of them, I think. Anders never had a redeeming quality to speak of, and Allison is weak. But Adam, I adored Adam. I always stood up for him when the pressure from his parents got to be too much. I would have done anything for that boy. And then, when he had the chance to keep my son safe, he didn't take it. All Adam would have had to do is say stop, either to Anders or to Matt. They would have listened to him. And Matt would still be alive. Foolish boy, could have changed it all with a word. Finally, I understand what Dr. Baxter meant when he said that about my father, and I feel a sudden rush of sympathy for the woman standing next to me. Then, an ominous click beside my ear drains away every emotion except fear. The problem with Adam is that he hasn't suffered enough, Teresa says tightly. He doesn't know what it's like to lose a child. Uncle Archer's eyes grow round and alarmed. Teresa, no. What else am I supposed to do with Adam's daughter? She asks. Just let her walk away? Like Adam let Matt walk away? My breath starts coming shallow and fast. Somewhere in the back of my panicked mind, I register the smell of gasoline. Or is it smoke? You're angry with my family. I understand that. You have every right to be, Uncle Archer says urgently. But if you think there's still a score to be settled, settle it with me, not Aubrey. His hands, which have been up all this time, fold over his heart like he's offering her a target. Take it out on me. I was there. I could have done something to help, and I didn't. That's the story of my entire goddamn life. Don't, I say. My heart is threatening to crawl into my throat. Kayla said you didn't know, Teresa says sharply. The smell of smoke is getting stronger. Are you telling me that you did? Uncle Archer's gaze darts between Teresa, me, and the gun before finally settling on me. The tense lines of his jaw soften. My heart constricts and then swells, painfully, when I recognize the look on his face. It's one I've never seen on anyone before. It's fatherly. Then he says, very simply, yes. Everything happens in a lightning-quick blur after that. The gun leaves my neck. Teresa's arm shifts, and I react instinctively. I crash my shoulder into hers, knocking her off balance and to the floor. A deafening blast fills the room, followed by a high-pitched scream of anguish. Sharp pain shoots through my elbow when I hit the ground, half on top of Teresa, and someone screams again. Red pools on the floor beside me as I twist my neck left and right, my eyes scanning wildly for Uncle Archer. Aubrey! He's above me, Teresa's gun dangling from one hand, and I almost pass out in relief. Are you hurt? I don't think so. I lift myself from Teresa, and she groans. Her left leg is covered in blood, and so is the floor beneath her. Her face is buried in the crook of her arm, and she's not moving other than breathing heavily. I think I shot her. She shot herself, he says grimly. We'd better call for help. Do you have your phone? I forgot mine. It's dead. I stand, the adrenaline that's been coursing through me draining fast, and the stench of smoke finally hits me in full. The air outside the sunroom looks thick and hazy. Paula, why don't you light a fire in the south parlor? That's what Teresa had said, just before her sister left the room. I step halfway through the door and peer into the hallway. There's a crackling, hissing noise coming from somewhere. The floor is slick and wet. Tess, are you sure? Positive. Something's wrong, I say. Then the hallway explodes into flames. Jesus, Uncle Archer shouts as I stumble backward into the sunroom. We have to get out. Come on. He reaches down to haul Teresa to her feet. She moans in protest, limp as a rag doll, and he heaves her into his arms. Stairs, Aubrey, to your left. We can't. Within seconds, the scene in front of us has transformed. Fire is everywhere, flames dancing and rolling through the hall. Smoke billows toward us, and I choke when the first wave hits me, sending me back into the sunroom, my eyes streaming. We have to, Uncle Archer says, pushing past me with Teresa in his arms. He backtracks just as quickly, gasping, okay, new plan. He drops Teresa into one of the leather armchairs in a corner of the room, then picks up the second chair and hurls it at the nearest window. The glass shatters, flying everywhere. I cover my nose and mouth with my hands as more smoke pours into the room. Uncle Archer picks up a long, old-fashioned umbrella from a decorative stand and swings it against the edges of the pane, clearing away jagged chunks of glass. I grab another umbrella to help and look down at the ground. My heart plummets. It's too far. We'll make a rope, Uncle Archer says, pulling a blanket from the back of the couch. I rip gauzy curtains from the window and turn to see what else might be in the room. There's a roaring sound at the door, and I watch in horror as flames zip up the crown molding that surrounds it, then spread to the nearest bookcase. At first, it's just a small orange line running along the top shelf, and then the books catch fire. The couch nearest the broken window is old-fashioned and heavy. Uncle Archer ties an end of the blanket to one of the couch's legs in a tight double knot, and the other end to the curtain I'm holding. It feels weightless in my hands. Will this work? I gulp. He knots the ends firmly, tests the hold, and doubles the knot. Is it strong enough? I ask. Uncle Archer looks around the room. The bookcase is consumed in fire, the ceiling above it also alight. The smoke is gray and black now, stealing breath from our lungs even with fresh air streaming in through the window. Flames lick an area rug and spread across its surface. "It'll have to do," he says, tossing the loose end of the knotted material out the window. "You first, Aubrey. Keep your body relaxed and try to land on your feet." There's no time to argue. I grab hold of the blanket beneath its knot near the couch and haul myself over the edge of the window. Shards of glass slice my arms and wrists, spattering the pale green blanket with blood. I lower myself as fast as I can. Before I know it, I've run out of blanket, then curtain, and I haven't gone far at all. I don't know how close I am to the ground, but it doesn't matter. There's nowhere to go but down. I let go of the curtain, and I fall. I slam into the ground feet first, my knees giving way as I tumble hard on my side. Everything hurts, but nothing so badly that I can't roll over and look at the house. The ground floor is fully alight. Smoke is pouring out the window I just came from. The curtain hangs loose, the bottom about 6 feet from the ground. There's no sign of my uncle or Teresa. I cup my hands around my mouth and scream, "Uncle Archer, come out!" Fighting back rising panic, I try to stand. Pain shoots up my right leg, forcing me back to my knees. "It's okay. It's not far. Hurry!" The window stays empty. My lungs hurt, making it hard to yell, but I keep at it, calling my uncle's name over and over and over until my throat is raw. And then, thank God, he appears. Teresa is slung over his shoulder, making his crawl out the window agonizingly slow. She's either unconscious or refusing to help, and as I watch him struggle through the billowing clouds of smoke, a furious thought sears my brain. Drop her. Just drop her. He doesn't. He inches down the makeshift rope until what's left of the window glows orange and the rope goes slack. They fall, and I hear a sound like the terrified scream of a dying animal. It takes a few seconds to realize it was me. "Uncle Archer!" I crawl toward the motionless lump of limbs and clothing that landed a few feet away. Teresa's face is turned toward me, her eyes empty and staring. I let out another involuntary animal sound and scramble past her until I reach my uncle's arm. "Please," I whisper, tugging at his wrist to turn it palm up. "Please." When I feel a pulse beat faintly against my thumb, I start crying for the first time all day.
Chapter 26. Millie. Catmint House burned to the ground that day. Teresa's sister, whose real name is Paula Donahue, had soaked it with gasoline before striking a match and taking off. Police have spent all week combing Gull Cove Island and staking out local airports, but there's no sign of her. I'm convinced she made it out of the country on a fake passport and is living off money that she and Teresa stole from Mildred and stashed away offshore. It's infuriating. At least Donald Camden, who didn't have the benefit of a head start, was arrested in his office and is in jail awaiting trial. Aubrey sprained her ankle in the fall from the window, and Uncle Archer suffered a concussion and dislocated his shoulder. According to medical examiners, Teresa Ryan probably died from smoke inhalation before she hit the ground. The land surrounding Catmint House is a crime scene now, so we're not allowed anywhere near it. But the day after the fire, Aubrey, Jonah, and I drove to the bend in the road where we'd first glimpsed the house. None of the destruction was visible from a distance, but there was something deeply unsettling about seeing an unbroken stretch of sky where the house used to loom. All of that history of Abraham and Mildred's legacy and my mother's childhood home just gone. Mom arrived the next day, taking charge like she always does. "You can't stay here," she insisted as soon as she set foot in Uncle Archer's bungalow. "It's not private enough. The media is in a frenzy." And just like that, we moved into a swanky story rental house. Since then, Mom's been acting as liaison with police, medical examiners, reporters, and lawyers, trying to untangle more than two decades of fraud. The one thing she hasn't done, though, is talk about what happened to Matt Ryan on Cuddy Beach that summer night, 25 years ago. I wanted to ask as soon as she stepped off the plane that brought her to Gull Cove Island Airport, but she pulled me into a stiff hug and said, "No questions, okay? Let's just get through today." She's been saying that every day since. I'm trying to give her space because I know that in addition to everything else she's handling, she has to come to terms with the fact that her mother she'd always hoped to reconcile with has been gone for 24 years, and that Mildred's story wasn't a villain after all, but a woman who got taken from her children without having a chance to say goodbye. Uncle Anders took off from Gull Cove Island as soon as the first article appeared. He's done a single interview since with Fox News. "It's all lies," he said about Kayla's story. "Made up by a bitter ex-girlfriend. May she rest in peace, of course." Uncle Adam isn't granting interviews, but he said the same thing through a spokesperson. Ironically enough, sales of his decade-old book went through the roof when the story broke. Just now, at 5 p.m. sharp, Aubrey got a text from him saying that he'd made the New York Times paperback bestseller list. She tosses her phone aside with a frown. "I guess there are no consequences for some people ever," she mutters. "Everyone except my mother is in the kitchen making guacamole for tonight's dinner. It's the last week of July, so there's still plenty of summer season left on Gull Cove Island. But not for us. Aubrey and Jonah are both leaving tomorrow, and I'll follow soon after. My parents want me to stay with Dad in Syria while Mom deals with the fallout here."
"I don't know,"
Archer says, wincing as he awkwardly chops avocados one-handed. His shoulder bothers him a lot, but he refuses to take pain medication.
"Your father still has to live with himself. I have a feeling that's been his problem all along."
It looks like that's the only punishment for Matt Ryan's death that Uncle Adam and Uncle Anders will ever get. Because Uncle Anders is right. The words of a girl who's been dead for 24 years, spoken to a woman who committed massive fraud before dying in a fire she told someone to start, isn't enough to convict anyone. The court of public opinion has been harsh, though. The New York Post splashed the question, "Is it murder?" across the front page a couple of days ago, and social media has answered with a resounding hell yeah. Uncle Adam might be getting a temporary boost in book sales, but for most people, it's a hate read. Aubrey still looks glum, so Uncle Archer changes the subject.
"Tell us about your new place," he says, scooping uneven avocado chunks into the food processor.
She brightens. Her mother flew in for a day and then had to leave to finish making arrangements for the apartment she and Aubrey will move into when Aubrey returns to Oregon. "It's a really cute three-bedroom condo, about halfway between school and the hospital where Mom works," she says.
"Sounds perfect," Uncle Archer says.
Aubrey gives him a shy smile. "Maybe you can visit, if you want." She and Uncle Archer have been spending a lot of time together since they rescued one another from Catmint House. I know part of Aubrey is always going to wish for the kind of father-daughter relationship that Uncle Adam isn't capable of having, but there's something to be said for the uncle-niece bond, too.
"I absolutely will," Uncle Archer says, "but not for a while."
Aubrey's face falls and he quickly adds,
"I'm going to be checking into a rehab center on Cape Cod next week. Not sure how long I'll be there, but at least a couple of months."
"That's great," Aubrey and I say in near unison.
"It's overdue,"
Uncle Archer says. His red Solo cup is on the kitchen island, like always, but he hasn't touched it since we sat down.
"After that, I'm not sure. One day at a time."
He looks exhausted suddenly and heaves himself off the stool.
"You mind finishing up? I'm going to try to take a nap."
We murmur our assent and he leaves. Silence falls for a few minutes until Jonah asks,
"So, what are you guys doing when you get home?"
"Physical therapy," Aubrey says promptly. "Turns out swimming is good for a sprained ankle, and I want to keep at it." She reaches for a clove of garlic and starts to peel it.
maybe even get back on the team. That startles me enough that I pour too much olive oil into the food processor and have to scoop some out with a spoon. Really? They're getting a new coach, Aubrey says, since the old one is going on maternity leave. Her expression darkens momentarily, but then her good cheer returns. It's a woman who ran a summer program I did once. She reached out to say hi and that she hopes I'm coming back. I really like her. She nudges me with one shoulder. What about you? What are you doing at Casa Dad? He's in New York too, right? Yeah, I say, recapping the olive oil. My instructions are to lie low. What does that mean? Her eyes widen in fake innocence. No more paparazzi shots of you making out on the beach? One time, I say, cheeks burning. The beach here is private, but helicopters keep hovering above us, angling for a shot. One of them caught a surprisingly clear close-up of me and Jonah kissing in the ocean. That happened once. Jonah clears his throat. Probably wouldn't even be an issue if we were someplace more crowded where we could blend in. I raise my eyebrows at him and he adds, like a city. Providence and New York aren't that far from one another. There's a bus that only costs $13, so I've heard. By obsessively checking the Greyhound site? Aubrey asks brightly. He shrugs. Possibly. I fight off a smile. I thought you had to work all summer. Not all summer, Jonah says. His expression turns pensive. Although, you guys are practically heiresses now, so I don't know. Maybe it'd be too weird. The Story Estate isn't something we've talked about since Teresa and Donald were exposed, but it's always in the background. When Mom came to the island, she brought that diamond teardrop necklace she had promised me, but I've only tried it on once. Somehow, it didn't look as good on me as I had thought it would. I put my grandfather's watch away, too. It's strange, but not in a bad way, how much lighter my arm feels without it. Nothing about the Story fortune seems real yet, but Jonah does. And I'm not ready to say a permanent goodbye any more than he is. It wouldn't be weird. At all, I tell him. He grins, and I pick up a spoon and point it at him for emphasis. I'm not taking a bus, though. Ever. That part is non-negotiable. Hours later, after Aubrey's gone to bed and Jonah is locked into some multiplayer video game with friends from home, I wander outside and see my mother and Uncle Archer sitting on two Adirondack chairs arranged on a strip of beach near the house. I almost go back inside, not wanting to bother them, but my mother catches sight of me and waves me over.
Let me get you a chair. Uncle Archer half rises before I motion for him to stop.
It's okay. I don't like those chairs anyway. There's a towel draped over the edge of my mother's seat, and I spread it on the ground to sit at their feet.
I was just telling Archer how happy I am that you and Aubrey have gotten close, Mom says.
There's a table between her and Uncle Archer, holding a single glass of wine. Mom lifts it and takes a sip before adding,
She's a gem. It's hard to believe now how little effort I expended over the years to help you know your cousins.
I put on a breezy tone because I'm trying not to think about Aubrey flying across the country. Our long-distance chats are going to be non-stop.
Well, in JT's case, that was a good call.
Uncle Archer shakes his head.
I'm still holding out hope for that kid. He was just trying to do his own thing this summer. I'll bet part of him is sorry for what happened.
A very small part, I say. An earlobe, maybe.
You always did refuse to see the worst in people, Archer, Mom says.
It's been strange watching her and Uncle Archer slip into old patterns this week. Very old patterns, from their teenage years, as opposed to the strained politeness I remember from my childhood. I'd observed closeness between the two of them in old videos, but never in real life, and I almost believed it was a trick of the camera. But it's not.
I guess we have that in common, Archer says.
He makes a fist with one hand and bops it gently against my mother's arm.
Couldn't even see it in our own brothers.
Mom stirs restlessly in her chair.
Have I used up all my let's discuss that later chips?
You don't have to talk about anything you don't want to, Uncle Archer says.
But I do want to tell you that I'm sorry for what you went through that summer, with the pregnancy and all. I knew something was wrong, but I had no idea it was that.
Well, how could you? Mom asks.
I didn't tell you, and it was over almost before it started. She takes another sip of wine. I was both sad and relieved. I felt for a while like I hated Matt, but I didn't, really. I was just angry about how he acted. And then Anders told me what he'd done, and Matt died so horribly, and I had no idea what to do.
Uncle Archer waits a beat, and when my mother doesn't continue, he asks quietly,
"Did you ever think about telling anyone?"
"Every day." Mom grips the stem of her wine glass so hard that I'm afraid it might break.
I was so conflicted. I felt guilty because I'd provoked Anders by telling him about Kayla and Matt, and because Anders almost made it sound as though he'd done it for me. And all I could think was, did I communicate in some way that I'd wanted this? Was it my fault? It took more than a year for me to understand that Anders was, as always, acting in his own self-interest. By that point, I couldn't think how to bring it up again, or what good it could possibly do. And then Donald Camden sent that letter. Mom finishes her wine and sets the glass down with a trembling hand. It felt like we deserved it. Well, all of us except you. Even though I thought Mother couldn't possibly have known about Matt. And of course, she didn't. Mom huffs out the least mirthful laugh I've ever heard. Now all I can think is, what if I had said something back then? Would everything be different now? Maybe Mother would still be with us and...
Allison, Uncle Archer interrupts, she wouldn't. She had a heart condition.
I don't know. It feels like the butterfly effect.
Mom's voice gets thick.
Especially now, knowing that Kayla's gone because of what I did.
Kayla's gone because Donald Camden is a greedy, soulless bastard.
Uncle Archer cracks. For the first time all night, he sounds angry.
And if anyone set that particular butterfly effect in motion, it was Anders. Which is horribly ironic.
I think he really did love Kayla, as much as Anders is capable of loving anyone. It has to hurt, knowing that what he did to Matt ultimately caused her death.
Uncle Archer taps his fingers rhythmically against the wooden arm of his chair, one after the other. From his index finger to his pinky, then in reverse. 1, 2, 3, 4. 4, 3, 2, 1.
I don't judge you, Allison. I'm angry at Adam for not saying something when it would have made a difference, but not at you for keeping quiet after it wouldn't. I'm not sure what I would have done in that situation. You know what Father used to say? Family first, always.
Mom still sounds on the verge of tears.
Father would have been horrified.
At them. Uncle Archer's voice softens.
You didn't set out to deliberately hurt anyone. Forgive yourself, Allison. 25 years is a long time to hang on to guilt.
I'm trying, Mom says. A cell phone on the table between her and Uncle Archer rings.
Who's Charlotte? Mom asks, looking down. An associate in Donald Camden's office,
Uncle Archer says.
I asked her to get in touch if she heard about any interesting developments. On the down low, of course. So, don't tell.
He puts a finger to his lips as he picks up his phone.
How do you know everyone?
Mom asks wonderingly.
I talk to people. You should try it. Hey, Charlotte.
Uncle Archer says, getting up and walking toward the beach.
What's up?
Silence falls between me and my mother. Then, to my surprise, she reaches down and strokes my hair. I can't remember the last time she did that, but I definitely wasn't more than 6 years old.
Being pregnant that summer was so lonely, she says reflectively. I couldn't bring myself to tell my mother. but I kept wishing that she'd guess somehow. Millie, if you are ever in a situation like that, I hope you know that you have my full support. I push aside my natural inclination to say, God, Mom, please don't talk about that, because I want her to talk about it, just not in relation to me. But I'll take what I can get at the moment. I know. Do you? Her laugh is brittle. I'm not sure I've done a very good job of showing you my support over the years. Well, you've had a lot going on, I hedge. I'll take that as affirmation that I could improve my parenting, she says dryly. Mom, did you? I hesitate, then decide to plunge right in. Did you ever tell Dad what happened? Not all of it. Mom tucks a strand of hair behind my ear before withdrawing her hand. Your father is the kindest man I've ever known. He did so much over the years to help me come to terms with what happened to Matt and with the pregnancy, but I couldn't finish the story. I never could tell him what Anders had done, or that I protected him. Her voice dips low. I twist my neck to get a look at her face, but the moonlight is too dim. The truth was like a cancer inside me by that point, and I'd shoved it down so far that it wouldn't come out. It just festered and made me angry. Your father took the brunt of that without ever knowing why. Sadness settles over my chest at the thought of what life could have been like if my mother had ever unburdened herself. I think he would have understood. I think you're right, she says quietly. We're silent for a minute, listening to the waves lapping against the shore and the indistinct murmur of Uncle Archer's voice. Then Mom clears her throat and says, I've been meaning to tell you, Millie, how impressed I am with the way you pieced the truth together. You have a sharp mind. I wait for the inevitable follow-up. If you applied yourself that way at school, you'd have an A average in no time. But it doesn't come. And a good heart, is all she says. And I feel the soft sting of tears behind my eyes. Uncle Archer comes back then, holding his phone and breathing hard. Mom gets to her feet and hurries toward him. Are you okay? She asks. Does your shoulder hurt? You keep overextending yourself.
No.
Uncle Archer's voice is strained.
That was Charlotte.
I know, Mom says. You told us.
Right. The thing is...
He stuffs his phone into his pocket and runs a hand through his hair.
I asked her to let me know if anything important came up. It has. The bigwigs aren't telling us yet because there's still a lot of paperwork to go through, but... Allison, Catmint House wasn't insured. Neither was any of the art or jewelry or furniture.
I turn toward my mother, who's blinking in confusion.
What? Why?
She asks. How on earth is a house like that not insured?
Nothing is, Uncle Archer says. All the policies have lapsed. No bills have been paid on anything for more than a year. The other houses our family owns, including this house, are in foreclosure. The investment accounts are empty. Donald and Teresa have been selling art to live on. Anything they hadn't sold yet went up in literal flames last week.
My mother doesn't say a word. Uncle Archer puts his hand on her shoulder and speaks slowly and patiently, his voice full of kindness and concern, like a doctor delivering a diagnosis that's going to hurt like hell, but not actually kill you.
They spent it all. Every last penny. The Story estate is gone.
Epilogue, Jonah. 5 months later, Millie breaks and balls go flying across crisp green felt. She just keeps getting better and better at pool. The last time I visited her in New York, when she took me to some swanky entertainment complex where all the tables were rimmed with fluorescent lights, she came uncomfortably close to beating me. Somebody's about to give you a run for your money, Jonah, Enzo calls from behind the bar. He returned to work at Empire Billiards right after Thanksgiving, although he still does a couple shifts at Home Depot every week, just in case. You've been practicing without me, haven't you? I ask as Millie watches the last of the balls drop into a corner pocket. I am Stripes, she announces, giving me a coy glance from beneath her lashes. There it is. That's the look that gets me every time. I forget where we are and reach for her, plucking the pool cue out of her hand so I can pull her close. Her silky hair is long and loose, and I brush it from her face before I kiss her. She lets out a soft sigh and melts into me, and I forget all about the endless 3 weeks since I saw her last. I also forget about Enzo until he coughs. Parent, parking lot, he says, and I release Millie a few seconds before my mother walks through the door. Not that she'd mind. She loves Millie, and she's the one who invited her to stay with us after Christmas. But I'm trying to keep the awkward factor low so that Millie won't ever hesitate to come back. By train, of course. She wasn't kidding about the bus. Mail came, Mom says to Enzo, dropping a thick pile of paper on the bar. There's a new catalog from Serve More Bar Supply, if you're interested. I am, he says, plucking it from the stack with reverence. Ever since his stint at Home Depot, you can't keep Enzo away from DIY projects to improve Empire Billiards. We don't open for another hour, but he got here early to install what he claims is a more durable bar rail. Mom turns to Millie and me. I'm going to make myself a burger and some fries before we open. You two want anything? Same, I say, with a questioning look toward Millie. Me too, she says. Thanks, Mrs. North. Of course. Anything for you, Enzo? Nah, I'm good. Okay, just give me 10 or 15 minutes, kids. Mom disappears into the kitchen. Enzo tucks the catalog and the rest of the mail under his arm. I'll be reading this in the office for the next 10 minutes, he announces, ducking out from behind the bar. Do with this empty room what you will. I moved a respectable distance from Millie when Mom came in, but closed the gap now with a grin. Where were we? I ask, circling her waist with my hands. She stretches on her toes to peck me on the lips, then pulls away. We were about to call Aubrey, remember? I promised I'd FaceTime her at 4. God damn it, I say, but I don't mean it. I'm looking forward to catching up with Aubrey, too. I wasn't sure what would happen when the three of us left Gull Cove Island at the end of July. We just lived through the wildest, weirdest month imaginable, and it was hard to tell whether the intense relationships we'd formed with one another would last in regular life, especially with all the estate stuff and such a colossal mess. It turned into a story sibling showdown. Allison and Archer on one side, trying to untangle what was left and settle it fairly, and Adam and Anders on the other, dodging creditors and accountability while slapping nuisance lawsuits on anyone who'd ever worked with Donald Camden. At first, I couldn't believe all the money was gone. But in the end, it very nearly was. Donald, Teresa, Fred Baxter, and Paula had lived high on the hog for 24 years, surrounding themselves with the kind of luxury I can't even imagine. They took extravagant trips, bought priceless art and other collectibles that they didn't bother to insure, and renovated the Story property so extensively that even those mile-high hotel rates couldn't keep up. Dr. Baxter's gambling problem never went away, so he lost millions in Vegas every year. Donald Camden barely worked. He kept a shell of an office and a skeleton staff so he'd look respectable, and spent more on that every year than he came close to taking in. By the time the dust settled, the amount left over for Adam, Anders, Allison, and Archer to split was, relatively speaking, minuscule. Just enough to pay for rehab, Archer likes to say. But at least, since he's been sober for 5 months, it was good rehab. Archer cares less than anyone about being broke. He's back on Gull Cove Island, working for Rob Valentine, and he's oddly serene about painting buildings that his family used to own. Greed pulled this family apart, he told Millie when we visited him over a Veterans Day weekend. He looked good, clear-eyed and clean-shaven, if a little on the thin side. And honestly, if there'd been anything of significance left at this point, it probably would have happened all over again. I don't want to spend my life fighting with Adam and Anders over the family fortune. And I don't want to see it warp you like it did us. And Donald and Teresa and the rest of that messed up crew. Maybe, Millie said grudgingly, but still, it wasn't their money to spend. No, it wasn't, Archer agreed. Let's look on the bright side, though. I don't want it. I really don't. I'm happier living a quiet life back home than I've been in years. Allison doesn't need it. She's built a fantastic career all on her own. Megan's done the same, so Aubrey will be just fine. Not to mention all those swim scholarships heading her way. And as for Adam and Anders, he permitted himself a small smile then. They don't deserve it. Adam Story's book fell off the bestseller list after 2 weeks. For a while, we were sure he'd be asked to write another. But the only story that people are interested in hearing from him is his own. And that's the one he refuses to tell. Anders Story and his family still live in Providence, but JT and I don't go to the same school anymore. He's finishing his senior year at some charter school outside Newport. Long commute, but it has the benefit of being full of kids who don't know him, except by name. The Story scandal was a big deal on the East Coast for months, so he can't escape it entirely. Anders is starting a new company, which I know nothing about other than what he shared with the Providence Journal last week. Everything I've learned, everything I stand for, and everything I have will be poured into this new venture, he promised. My mother tossed the newspaper aside with a disgusted snort after she read that. In other words, nothing, she said. Teresa's sister, Paula, is still at large. I have to admit, she's the one who interests me the most. The dark horse of the group, always in the shadows, who had so little going on in her life when Mildred Story died that she could give it up to pose as Teresa. The media keeps trying to profile her, but there's not much to go on. 24 years ago, she was a 50-year-old woman living in a suburb of New Hampshire and working for the electric company. Then one day, she just left, quit her job, gave notice on her apartment, and said she was moving out of state. No one cared enough to ask why. I told Millie once that I thought that was sad. She glared at me. Lest you forget, you're talking about the woman who burned down Catmint House, she said. She could have killed Aubrey and Uncle Archer. Don't you dare feel sorry for her. I don't, I said. And it's true. I hate the idea of Paula sipping cocktails on some foreign beach as much as Millie does. It's just, I can't help but remember how hard it was to pretend to be someone else, even for a short time. Occasionally, I wonder how she pulled it off for as long as she did. And the same answer hits me every time. Because there wasn't a single person in the world, aside from the sister she agreed to impersonate, who would miss her. Okay, maybe I feel a weird pang of sympathy. But I'm sure as hell not telling Millie that. Because Millie, God, that I get to call her my girlfriend still feels like a miracle. We see one another as often as we can. And when we talk about what we're going to do post-graduation, it's always about how we're going to wind up in the same city, not whether. And who knows? Maybe our trio will reunite. Aubrey was offered a swimming scholarship to Brown, which is incredible, but she was also offered several a lot closer to home. Millie's making it her mission to lure Aubrey to the East Coast, starting now. We settle ourselves on the same side of a booth behind the pool table area, and Millie props up her phone between us. Once she's dialed Aubrey's number, she pulls off her moto jacket to reveal the Brown University t-shirt we picked up this morning. Aubrey appears on screen, holding a tiny squirming baby in the crook of one arm. Hey, it's Aiden, I say, then do a double take when I get a good look at the kid's face. The last time I saw him via FaceTime, he was a newborn. Now he's 2 months old and starting to resemble an actual person. One in particular, as it turns out. Holy shit, Aubrey, he looks exactly like you. She grins. I know, right? It drives my father crazy, especially since he's always insisted that I only have my mother's genes. She strokes the baby's tufty blonde hair with her free hand. I guess there's more than one way to look like a story. It shouldn't have surprised me, Aubrey being Aubrey, that she fell in love with her half-brother straight away. It's not like the mess he came out of was his fault. Still, it's pretty cool of Aubrey to be as involved with him as she is, when she could have easily held a grudge. Millie crosses her arms over her chest, forgetting her t-shirt as she eyes Aiden warily. Babies make her nervous, even when viewed through a screen. Is he going to cry? She asks. He never cries, Aubrey reassures her. He's the happiest little guy. Millie settles back in the booth, looking unconvinced but willing to give the baby the benefit of the doubt. And how are his parents? She spits out the last word like it tastes bad. Well, Aubrey jiggles Aiden meditatively. Everyone says babies are hard on a relationship, right? Let's just say, as easygoing as he is, this little guy has been especially hard. They're not talking marriage anymore. Coach Mattson got a new position a few towns over, but she really wants to stay home with Aiden. Dad, of course, refuses to get a job, and he's already burned through the settlement money and his royalties. I think Coach Mattson is finally starting to realize what she signed up for with him, and she is not happy. Millie leans toward the screen, her baby trepidation entirely gone. I'm gonna start calling you Karma, buddy, she coos. Aiden offers a toothless grin as Aubrey tries unsuccessfully to smother a laugh. You're terrible, Aubrey says, then shifts her glance to me. How's business? I give her a thumbs up. Better all the time. She beams. I can't wait to visit. I'm so sorry I couldn't this week. Our meet schedule is killing me right now, but spring break should definitely be doable. I want to go to Gull Cove and see Uncle Archer too. Perfect, Millie says, straightening her shoulders. You'll have accepted Brown's offer by then, and as you can see, she sweeps a hand across her chest, I'm preparing my celebratory wardrobe. Someone taps my shoulder, and I turn before I can see Aubrey's reaction. Postcard for you, Enzo says, handing it to me. Really? I ask, bemused. I never get mail. Thanks. The front of the postcard shows the New York City skyline, and I immediately think of Millie. I tug on a lock of her hair and ask, did you send me a postcard? She swats me away, eyes on her phone. Hold on a sec, I'm in recruiting mode. I flip the postcard, scanning my name and Empire's address. It's not Millie's neat, loopy handwriting. The words are all cramped together, reminding me of the note we got from Mildred when we first arrived on Gull Cove Island, telling us she'd been called away to Boston. Although, I guess it was actually Teresa who wrote that. Or Paula. Holy hell. Paula. Dark Horse Paula. The woman nobody would miss. All of the hairs on the back of my neck stand up as I glance at Millie. She's still deep in conversation with Aubrey, so I shift my eyes down and read the note. Jonah, I hear that you, Millie, and Aubrey are doing well, and I am glad. Truly. I bear you no ill will, and while I suppose it is fanciful to imagine that you and your cousins might reciprocate that sentiment, I hope it is the case. From one impostor to another, I'd like to give you some words of advice. Keep your parents far away from Anders Story's new venture. I have a strong suspicion that it will one day, as they say, go up in flames. Family first. Always. P.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Cousins by Karen M. McManus, with Sarah Scare as Millie, Kate Reinders as Aubrey, David Gerlich as Jonah, and Julia Whalen as Allison. This program was directed by Joseph Grimm. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Edited by Tim Bader Audio. Text copyright 2020 by Karen M. McManus, LLC. Production copyright 2020 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.